This is Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Lynn Zook. She has a new book out called Gambling on a Dream about vintage Las Vegas. Lynn, it's great talking to you.
You as well. I'm very excited to be here, so and looking forward to talking more about the book.
And you also run the website Classic Vegas, where you document historical archives and photographs of Las Vegas.
Yes, classiclasvegas.com. That's me.
So you're actually a Vegas native. Can you talk about your background and how you got interested in sort of the history of the city and like archiving the history?
I grew up in Las Vegas during that magical period, the 1960s through the early 1970s, when it was the entertainment capital of the world. And for years, I thought that the front of Caesar's Palace would always be turquoise and the Dune sign would always be there. And that would just be the way it was, because that was the Las Vegas I knew. And then the dunes got imploded and the sign went away and the front of Caesars is no longer turquoise. And it became very, very important to me to help preserve as much of the 20th century history of the town as possible. And so I created the Classic Las Vegas Historic Project and interviewed over 100 longtime and native-born Las Vegans and got them on videotape talking about the Las Vegas that they knew. And from that came the documentary, The Story of Classic Las Vegas, An Overview. And out of all of that came the book, Gambling on a Dream, which has both video and images, along with a detailed history of the first 10 hotels on the Las Vegas Strip.
In your new book, Gambling on a Dream, it focuses on the years 1930 to 1955.
Yes.
Would you say those are the crucial years? Because I also think of like the 60s and 70s as being kind of an extension of the era of vintage Vegas.
Well, 1956, from the Hacienda through the original MGM Grand in 1973, that is my next book, part two, will cover those hotels. But it was important for me to detail the history of the first 10 hotels to kind of set the story up for the next nine, because if you don't talk about the El Rancho Vegas, you can't just start talking about the Hacienda. You have to talk about the hotels that were there first and kind of blaze the trail for everything that came after.
When did they start demolishing the original hotels? Was that around the sort of, was that the mostly starting in the 90s or even prior to that?
It mainly started in the 90s. It started when Sheldon Adelson threw in with the makers of Con Air to take down the Sands, which was a very pivotal hotel, probably the one hotel that is, the most iconic when we think of Las Vegas. It was the home to the Rat Pack and home to, the stars individually and just the amount of talent that crossed that stage. And then in the late 90s, with the destruction of the dunes and the destruction of that sign, it started then, and then it kind of snowballed from there. And, luckily we still have the Tropicana, we still have Caesars, we still have Circus Circus, and to a degree we still have the International.
I didn't get a chance to visit Vegas until 2010. I mean, my parents never took me there as a kid in the 90s, even though back then there was still a lot of remnants. But when my first trip to Vegas, I stayed in downtown and I stayed at the Golden Nugget. So there's a lot of the older stuff downtown, but there's very little left on the Strip.
Probably for the third book I do in the series, I will concentrate on Fremont Street and the downtown area. So I'm looking forward to that. But first, I have to get the second part of Gambling on a Dream done.
And that second part, that covers mostly the 60s and 70s?
Yes. Up till the original MGM Grand, because we always have to, make sure that, when we say MGM Grand, most people, if they don't know the history of the Las Vegas Strip, they tend to think of the MGM Grand that's there now. And the original MGM Grand was probably the classiest hotel that ever graced the Las Vegas Strip.
Last time I was in Vegas, I stayed at the Flamingo. That is one of the original hotels. But the one that exists now, when was that? I think, when was that built, the one that's standing there now?
Well, it's all part of the original. Flamingo just celebrated on December 26th, the day after Christmas, celebrated its 70th anniversary. But the bones of the original hotel are, underneath all of that renovation and the new towers and all of that. That is all part of the original Flamingo Hotel.
And recently the Riviera was demolished. And I think that was the big thing that happened this year. So the last Circus is still there. And you mentioned the Tropicana. Can you talk about the history of the Riviera and the demolition recently?
The Riviera opened. It was one of three hotels that opened in 1955, the Royal Nevada and the Dunes being the other two. And out of the three of them, the Riviera lasted the longest. Liberace opened the Riviera, and it was his home. They managed to get him away from the Hotel Last Frontier, and he opened the Riviera, and that was his home until Kurt Kerkorian stole him away for the International Hotel. But it was the first high-rise on the Strip, and there was a lot of concern that...
When was
that
the
nine
high
stories,
rise,
it was the first
high-rise built?
When it opened. In 1955, it was nine stories tall, and there was some concern that it would pancake down, that it wouldn't be, the foundation wouldn't hold. And the hotel proved them all wrong and, withstood the test of time, so to speak. And along with, additions over the years and renovations, to its credit, it was one of the few hotels where you could chart the entire history of renovations and makeovers through the years, just, walking through the property. And unfortunately, the Las Vegas Convention Authority decided that they needed a bigger parking lot, and so they bought the property and brought the hotel down in stages.
And what's really kind of a sad about that area is, like, in the case of the Sands, they tore that down and built basically billion-dollar casino, the Venetian, extremely extravagant. But in a lot of these cases, I think some of these hotels, they've been demolished and they've just been sitting there as these empty parking lots for a decade. It's a massive waste.
Well, I mean, part of it is, the whole trend towards bigger and modern and all of that is that you lose that sense of you know, especially in the showroom, because back in the day, the showroom sat like, you know, 600, maybe 700 people maximum. And you got, that's the way to see a show, is you with 600 of your closest friends versus nowadays where it's you and 2,500 of your closest friends. So you lose that intimacy with the performer. You lose the that intimacy in the casino where, you know, the dealers no longer know your name and that sort of thing. And that was one of the things that the original guys who built the hotels understood better than anybody was, you know, get them through the door, treat them like kings, and they will, you know, they'll return the value to you by staying and playing and losing money, but having a great time and going home and telling all their friends about what a great time they had in Vegas, even though, you know, they lost a boatload of money.
I've done a lot of paintings of that, of like the vintage strip, and especially like the original Riviera Marquis. I know some of the signage from the front was salvaged. Do you know what happened to the original marquee from the Riviera, the one that originally faced the Las Vegas Boulevard?
The original sign that looked like a canopy with a toothpick through it, that one got destroyed when they added the new very large roadside sign that ended up ultimately on the backside of the hotel that on Paradise. And well, that sign ended up in the the boneyard of the Neon Museum.
I was in Las Vegas, I think, about like 2 years ago. I saw that original sign located on the other end of the hotel of Riviera, closer to the Hilton. Are you saying that one was
that was the second sign. And that one is in that one got donated to the Neon Museum's boneyard. So the problem with a lot of the large signs, especially the big sign like the Dunes or the Stardust sign, is, you know, they were so large and it took a lot of power to make them glow, and you could not take them apart easily and salvage them. And that's why 9 times out of 10, it's not the sign that remains, it's the letters, because you can't just keep part of the sign. If you cut into the neon, you're going to, you know, destroy the sign. And so that's why 9 times out of 10, it's the letters that survive more than the sign.
I know with the Riviera, A lot of the smaller signage was saved. I heard one of them was shipped up to a museum in Reno. Was the facade along the front of Las Vegas Boulevard, was that added like in the, I heard it was added in the 80s?
It was designed by one of the few female neon designers by the name of Marge Williams. And
Marge Williams designed the original one I was talking about. I'm talking about the one that was added later on, like with the stars.
Yeah. She did the neon facade. The second sign, the one that ended up on the backside of the hotel, was done by Ben Chapman. But Marge was one of the few female neon designers, and she designed that entire neon star facade that the Riviera put up in the late 1980s. Pieces of that were donated to the Neon Museum.
Oh, so you're saying the larger one was the one that one was destroyed?
The sign that was on Paradise, pieces of that were donated to the Neon Museum, yes. A lot of the neon from the Riviera that did get saved, which, you know, for which, you know, we're very, very grateful. Bill Boyd did the same thing with the Stardust. He donated the letters from the sign and pieces of the sign to the Neon Museum as well when he took the Stardust down.
I heard when the Frontier was demolished, the sign of the Frontier was up longer, but then I read somewhere that Steve Wynn wanted it removed because he thought it was an eyesore. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, Steve Wynn is not a big fan of neon signage. And so I believe the letters were donated to the Neon Museum, but I'm not sure.
Has there been any push for like historic preservation laws in Las Vegas? A lot of cities have them, but the thing is, they're usually about structures, not so much signage.
Yeah. There are a couple of historic preservation groups in Las Vegas. There's the Nevada Historic Preservation Group. There's also a Southern Nevada Historic Preservation Group. And they do what they can to save, mainly houses and archives and things like that. But there's not a real... part of the problem is the hotels are owned by corporations, and you can't really tell them what they can and cannot do with the buildings that they own.
I also think one of the issues is Vegas is a fairly new city. Like, obviously, older cities like New York and San Francisco, and even L.A. to a degree, have stricter historic preservation laws. But because Vegas is so new, they sort of, it's a city that's constantly like reinventing itself.
Yes, and that's a big problem for historic preservation, is you always have an influx of new people who don't understand the history. I mean, we're seeing it in the downtown area right now with the closing of the Bayou and Mermaids on Fremont Street. The Bayou, that building dates back to the 1930s when it was the Northern Club, and it was owned by Mamie Stocker, and she received the first gaming license from the city to operate that club. And so preservation groups are working hard with the owner of the building to somehow, preserve it for its next life, because to lose it would be a big blow to the history of Fremont Street.
With Fremont Street, it has survived better. Is it because of the historic preservation pressure, or is it more because it's less economically desirable as the factor that there's more economic pressure on the Strip? Has that been the main reason that the Fremont hotels have survived? And do you think in the future, do you think that hotels like the Plaza and the Fremont Casino and the Four Queens, like, do you see those hotels and casinos in Fremont as being in danger in the near future?
I don't see them as in danger as, say, the Tropicana or Circus Circus, because the majority of people that come to Las Vegas, they come for the Strip. There is a big movement to get people to come downtown. I mean, the best example I can give of how to market a historic property downtown is to follow the lead of what the El Cortez has done. The El Cortez is over 70 years old, and it is still going strong. They have kept its original facade. They went in and renovated the place and kept as much of the original charm as they could. And, they're doing a land office business there. And it's like, if you want, if you own a historic property, look at what the El Cortez is doing and follow their lead, because they have figured it out.
What are your thoughts on the idea of building like a newer casinos in sort of the vintage style, and have there been any proposals?
There were a number of proposals. The problem is, I think the biggest problem I see with that is you can either have an intimate hotel or you can have a very large resort. and most property owners want to have a very large resort to get as many people through the door as possible. And as I said earlier, if you're going to do that, then you sacrifice the intimacy of what made the Las Vegas Strip so desirable in its formative years, because back then it was hotel, big swath of desert, hotel. You couldn't walk the strip, so you tended to stay at the hotel where you were anchored and occasionally take a cab maybe to another hotel or something like that. But for the most part, if you came to Las Vegas and you were staying at the Sands, you didn't necessarily leave the property very much while you were there. And today, you know, everybody's got more options because now you can walk the strip. The problem with walking the strip is all the properties are built out to the street, and you lose that sense of what made all that neon so wonderful, because the original hotels were built for the car culture. You know, you would come down that lonely highway, and from a distance, you could see the neon signs, and you would pull into, you know, your property, and that's where you stayed.
You're saying originally the strip, it was parking lots in front of the hotels instead of it was less pedestrian friendly?
It was, what you did was they had these long driveways that led up to the porte cochere where, you know, the valets would come and they'd take your bags and usher you in. And they all had beautiful plate glass windows, and you could see the air-conditioned coolness on the other side of those windows. And it was like, how do I get in there as quickly as possible, especially when it's 115 degrees outside and your car doesn't necessarily have air conditioning? And so you drove up, you know, there was a huge neon sign. There was the hotel. And it was like, okay, how up the long driveway to the valet and into the hotel. And then it was like paradise. And part of it is we have given up that, you know, that sense of wonder as you drove up the long driveway and saw the lobby and saw the hotel in all its glory. We've given that up for being built completely out to the street and walking. And, you know, it's just a difference in the generations. But one thing's for sure, we definitely lost something along the way. Because Las Vegas no longer has that sense of wonder that we all remember from our collective memory.
Do you talk about, in your blog, Classic Vegas, you talk about the mid-century architecture. You talk about, like, the airport terminals, and I've been to one of the terminals, like they do the airport at the McCarran Airport has like a mid-century kind of a space age aesthetic.
Yes, and to a degree it still does. I believe it is the Delta Terminal, which was designed by a Los Angeles architect, a patron saint of mid-century modern Los Angeles, Wilton Beckett. And that terminal, even through all the renovations and everything, you can still walk into that terminal and it's the original design. It's, you know, glass on all sides for the gates and all of that, and it still retains a lot of its charm. I don't know, you know, if it's by design or by happenstance, but thank God, you know, they have managed to hang on to it. Because when it first opened back in the 70s, it was, you know, ahead of its time. And now it's still hanging in there.
You also mentioned kind of the Somerset Shopping Center. And that's kind of what's kind of interesting about that is it's this kind of obscure, kind of off-the-strip place that you would think would be kind of run down with like these, it's like liquor stores and cheap businesses, but it has this a really cool sign, but it's kind of off the strip. Actually wrote about that in your blog.
That sign was designed for the car culture, because you see that sign long before you see that little shopping center. And back in the day, the shopping center was where, you know, the showgirls would go. There was a pharmacy in there and barbershops and stuff like that. And that's where the show people, the line dancers and the busboys and stuff like that, because they could go, those businesses would be open, you know, when they got off work, which, you know, what, you know, back then was unheard of in the rest of the country, because Las Vegas was the original 24/7 town. And the Somerset Shopping Center was a prime example of it. Over the years, it's lost a lot of its luster. And, but, you know, part of that is just A, due to its location and the fact that the entire city and the entire world is now a 24/7 town.
There's also the Bonanza gift shop near the Stratosphere. Is that part of the, is that fairly old?
It's been there. It was originally the Jolly Trolley and Honest John's. It's had a couple of iterations on its way to becoming the Bonanza gift shop, but as the Bonanza gift shop, it's been there for almost 40 years at least. And it manages to hold on. I'm not quite sure how, because it's a prime location. It has a condo tower near it, and the Lucky Dragon, which just opened, is, you know, within walking distance of it. But somehow or other, that little strip mall hangs on. God bless it.
It's interesting you mentioned with the kind of a car culture. I'm not sure. Are you familiar with James Howard Kunstler?
I know the name, but I don't know the person.
He's like a he's a historic preservationist, but he's a major critic of like the car culture and the kind of petroleum based economy. And I kind of brought up this issue to him, but he was kind of dismissive of it, because he said, oh, that's part of the car culture, and that is unsustainable. Do you see that kind of attitude with a large segment of historic preservationists?
Well, I mean, the problem with that is the car culture built the Southwest. After, you know, I mean, the Southwest is dependent upon being able, whether you're in Las Vegas, whether you're in Phoenix, whether you're in Los Angeles, it's dependent upon being able to drive from place to place, because we never had the sort of mass transit, the old mass transit that they have back east. I mean, you know, in New York, you can take the train to Connecticut. Well, out here in the West, you can't really take the train from Los Angeles to Las Vegas in the same amount of time, because it's further and there's a lot more open space. But, you know, the Southwest was a big component of the car culture. And now we're playing catch up to get, you know, get on the mass transit, whether it's rail or subways, to get around. And, you know, that's all good and fine. I mean, Las Vegas has a monorail. You have to be on that side of the strip for it. It's kind of like, well, thinking about it, you know, and putting it together, you know, why they didn't just, you know, put it right down the median so that, you know, people could cross Vegas Boulevard and get on the monorail and go someplace.
You actually have
but
all the way through the casino. It's like a long walk, so it's not that practical.
No. And, you know, that's a problem with design. It's not a problem with the idea of mass transit. You know, I mean, for years they've been trying to get, you know, a monorail from downtown to the strip and from the strip out to the airport. But they haven't cracked that conundrum yet. I don't know why, because it would make perfect sense. But they've been, you know, talking about it for at least the last 15 years.
Currently, so, which original casino do you see in most danger of being demolished? Would you probably say the Tropicana or Circus Circus?
Yeah, I think they're very viable contenders to be the next ones on the block. They're kind of neck and neck. mean, they've both gone through major renovations. And, you know, when Circus Circus first opened, it wasn't a hotel. It was just a casino. Jay Sarno realized after the fact how important it was to have a hotel as part of the casino, because if people can't stay where they gamble, they're not as, you know, likely to they like to be able to stay where they gamble. And so the hotel was an add-on to Circus Circus. But, you know, they're both aging properties that there hasn't been a sense of design through the various renovations, and they're kind of like, you know, the same problem of Flicks, to a lesser degree, Caesar's Palace, which is more of a Winchester mystery house than it is a hotel. And, you know, you look at the design and it just looks like, you know, somebody vomited all over Rome. It makes no sense.
As far as newer casinos go, have any of them, have you seen sort of any innovation in the signage or the design, or would you say in general you're not a fan of the newer Vegas casinos?
I'm not a big fan. I'm certainly not a big fan of the LED lighting. I really prefer the soft glow of neon, but, you know, that's just me. But, I mean, the LED signs are so big and so bright that if you're at a traffic light on the strip on Las Vegas Boulevard South and you're staring at that sign for too long, it, you know, it's just, you know, it's as bright as the sun. It's like, okay, yes, please stop, which is not a problem you have with neon. But I'm an old-fashioned girl. I like the Las Vegas I grew up with, and I miss it. And I realized that, you know, you can't go back in time and you can't recreate it. So, you know, that's what I try to do in my books, is to give the reader a sense of what each hotel used to be like, with a detailed history of each hotel from conception through implosion, or in the case of the Flamingo, still going strong after all these years. Because, you know, I think if people can appreciate, they might have more of an appreciation for the Las Vegas today if they understand where it came from. Because without those original hotels, the Las Vegas Strip of today would be a very different animal indeed.
Has most of the interest for your work and the interest in vintage Vegas, has it come more from locals, or has it been sort of an international interest that people have visited?
It's actually more of an international interest, because I was very surprised that people they want to know more about the Las Vegas that was there before the Las Vegas of today. And so I'm very heartened by the fact that so many people are so interested in the city's history. And I wish there was a way that, you know, historic preservationists could harness that interest. But, you know, that's a real tough nut to crack. But, you know, I work with various museums and various archives to help get that history out to the public, to make it, you know, to make the true stories versus the myths. I concentrate more on the actual history instead of the myths, because, you know, the myths are easy, but they're myths and they don't have any basis in fact. And I want to concentrate on the real history, because it's 10 times more interesting than the myths.
Are there some vintage casinos outside of Vegas, like in towns like Gene? Is the Gold Strike one of the original? Is that fairly old?
It's been there probably for 30 plus years. Sam's Town has been there for, I want to say, a good 30 plus years. The idea of the local casinos is something that became rather fashionable in the late 70s and the early 80s. And the local casinos tend to give more of that intimate approach to gaming than the strip. But they all, you know, they all seem to take their cue from the El Cortez. And I can't say enough great things. And I'm not paid by the El Cortez to say enough great things about them. But they figured out how to keep it intimate and keep people coming back and make their history part of their legacy.
I mean, really the beginning of the big, like, resorts, it started with the Mirage, like, that was around, like, 89. Interestingly enough, I mean, the 80s, yeah, the late 80s, in the era of vintage Vegas, I think the 70s is seen as a cutoff. What sort of happened in the sort of in-between era, like, say, like, for most, like, the late 70s to about for most of the 80s?
Well, part of it is, you know, it was the changing taste and culture, you know, from the 40s through the early 70s. It was performers that you saw on that were, you know, on variety shows every night on TV. And they were on, you know, the top singers and performers of their day. And going to see them in Las Vegas was a treat. But American tastes changed in the 70s from the Great American Songbook to rock and roll. And it took Las Vegas a while to adapt to that. I mean, we had the Aladdin Theater for the performing arts, and we had rock and roll performers performing there. I mean, the Beatles came here in 1964. And we had Iron Butterfly, and we had Jim Morrison in the Doors in the 60s, but they didn't perform on the Strip. They performed at the Convention Center, and Morrison and the Doors performed at the Ice Capade Chalet in Commercial Center off on Sahara. So it was, you know, the changing taste in American culture, the changing taste in music. And Steve Wynn figured out how to make, you know, hotels appealing for the resort age of America, which, you know, we're still in. And he's still figuring out, he still knows how to cater to those that, you know, it's less now about the gaming and more about the food and the shopping. And that's just a change in American taste than anything. And, you know, because Las Vegas was built on gaming.
Has there kind of an overall decline in neon signage, like nationwide and not just in Vegas?
I think there's been more of a decline in neon signage here than in other places throughout the West. Los Angeles, to its credit, did a whole relight. The city helped pay to relight a number of the rooftop neon signs, and the Neon Museum in Los Angeles goes to great lengths to preserve their signage. The Neon Museum there got started in the late 70s. The Neon Museum here got a much later start, and so they're still... but they're still doing a great job of preserving as much of the neon history of the city as possible. But I think, you know, part of it is there are areas where neon is really, really popular. I don't know that it will ever come back to the Las Vegas Strip the way where it used to be king. But, you know, that's just... changes in American in attitudes of, you know, what we find fascinating. But I love neon signage, and I would love to see it come back, but I'm old enough to know that it's probably not going to happen in my lifetime in terms of being neon being king on the Strip again. And that's why preserving those images and the history of the men and women who built those signs is so important.
Do you know the most recent casino to use a neon sign? I know most of the newer ones use the LED.
Yeah. I think I'm hard pressed to come up with the name of a hotel that has, you know, used neon more than LED.
At what about least, the Paris one?
Yeah, but again, we're talking, you know, that hotel went up almost 20 years ago. So it's not something, it's, Paris is a beautiful, beautiful example. I mean, that balloon and the outline of the Eiffel Tower are both great examples of what can be done with neon in this new resort age. But the problem is most of the property owners go for the flashy, and the flashy these days is LED. You know, it's the same reason why, you know, when it comes to Christmas lights, we all have LED Christmas lights instead of the old C5s, because they're more economically efficient to use and require, you know, less power. So, you know, your power bill's not quite as big.
What's kind of interesting is in the past, I mean, even in the 80s, it was kind of neon was associated with the future. If you watch like a lot of these like future films from like the 60s, 70s, and 80s.
Yeah, but, you know, it's technology. Technology has changed, you know, the way we do a lot of things in this country. And, you know, I mean, America usually only goes one way, and that's forward. And so, you know, technology comes in, it changes, and it rides a wave. And then that wave crests and goes away, and something else will come and take its place. And I'm hoping it will be more like neon and less like LED when that happens.
What are your thoughts on the Polo Towers? Is that, I think that one also uses neon. Was that built about 30 years ago?
Yeah, well, that's an old building. The Polo Towers went up in the late 70s, I believe it was. And they still have their, you know, they keep their neon glowing. God bless them. Not a new building, unfortunately.
The really new ones use completely LED. A few of the ones from the 90s, like the Treasure Island, I know they use those like bulb signs. And I mean, the bulb signs were around a pretty long time. What are your thoughts on those types of signage?
Yeah, I enjoy them while you can, because chances are, you know, LED is what everybody's dabbling in right now, and what, you know, that's where the designers are working, unfortunately. And so, you know, anytime you find a neon sign in Las Vegas, worship it. Anytime you find, you know, a hotel that has a combination of LED and neon, worship it, because it's, you know, its days are probably numbered, unfortunately. And that's just, you know, that's technology.
We are getting close to the end of the show. Before I wrap things up, do you want to give our audience some information about your current book, Gambling on a Dream, and your upcoming projects?
Gambling on a Dream is a digital book. It's an e-book. It details the first 10 hotels in detail, their history of each hotel from conception through implosion, with the exception of the Flamingo, because it's still going strong. It's available on iTunes for people with Mac computers. It's available on Amazon for people with Kindles and Fire tablets. And it is available on Kobo and on Barnes & Noble's Nook, Nook Press. So it's out there. It's $4.99. And like I said, it has rarely seen images and video with men and women who were alive and helped create the history of that era. And part two, which will cover 1956 to 1973, will be available next summer via iTunes and Amazon and Kobo and Nook Press. And in the meantime, you can visit classiclasvegas.com for all the latest information about preservation of Las Vegas and more information about the book.
Lynn Zook, it's been an excellent show. I'd like to thank you for being on.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate this opportunity.